talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch die Rollen, Argus, Akhoisa.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, the life and legacy of a neglected revolutionary and politician, the brother of Harry Boland, who went on to become Ireland's longest-serving Minister for Justice. We'll also explore how a study of counterinsurgency strategies might better help us understand how the Free State won the Irish Civil War, and to end the show, how women professors changed the study of foreign languages in the 19th century, and in doing so, changed the shape of modern Ireland. You can email us on talkinghistory@newstalk.com, and we'd love to hear from you. We had very sad news during the week when we learned of the death of the much-loved classicist, Vic Connerty. Vic was our guest on various panels over the years, and every time he appeared, we would start getting texts from his former students in UCD wanting to tell him how much they loved him and what a difference he had made. Vic was a brilliant scholar, a wonderful communicator, and an inspiring teacher, and all of us here in Talking History would like to offer our condolences to his family and many friends. And we begin tonight's show with a new life of Gerald Boland. Gerald Boland, Irish militant revolutionary, politician and statesman, has until now ranked amongst the forgotten figures of modern Irish history. But a new book addresses this historical imbalance and provides a personal insight into many of the major military and political events which helped shape modern Ireland over the duration of his lifetime, from 1885 to 1973. The book is called Gerald Boland, A Life. It's published in paperback by Wordwell. The author is Stephen Kelly. And Stephen, you're very welcome back to the show.
Many thanks, Patrick. Thanks for having me.
Stephen, I might begin with the fact that Gerald Boland isn't as famous or as well known as his brother Harry Boland, or indeed even his son Kevin Boland.
Yes, so, well, in many ways, Gerald Boland, his life was, or the events of his life were determined really by the death of his older brother Harry Boland, who, of course, was very close to Eamon de Valera and was killed during the heights of the Irish Civil War. And it's because his brother unfortunately passed away, Gerald Boland inherited his seat as a Sinn Féin TD for Roscommon. And at the time of his brother's death, Gerald had no interest in politics and would never probably been engaged in that subject, only for the passing of his brother. And he then retained that seat in Roscommon for the next 50 years. So it's an unfortunate consequence of the death of his brother that propelled Gerald into public life. And then on the question about his son, Kevin, of course, yes, Kevin was, again, very unusually, he became, the day he was elected as a TD in 1957, he also became a government minister. Now, the reason for that is because of his father. Because we know now that when the election was called and the cabinet was being decided in 1957, after Fianna Fáil's triumphs, Sean Lamass went to Eamon de Valera and told him explicitly, I will not be in cabinet with Gerald Boland. So as a way of, if you like, diffusing the situation, de Valera, who was always a brilliant mathematician and someone who could calculate a deal, he went to Gerald and said, look, Gerry, if you step down, I'll appoint Kevin to cabinet. And that's exactly what happened. So again, as a consequence of his older brother passing away, Gerald became a prominent figure within Fianna Fáil, and a founding father of Fianna Fáil. And also because of his fallout with Sean Lamass later on, it was his son who was elevated to cabinet in 1957. It's extraordinary.
And you came across the unpublished memoirs of Gerald Boland.
Yes, this is, again, I would never have probably written this book only because I was bequeathed a copy of Gerald Boland's memoir. The background to this is quite interesting. When I was researching for my PhD way back in 2008, I went and interviewed Gerald Boland's son, Harry Boland. Now, for listeners who aren't aware of who Harry Boland was, he was an extraordinary man in himself. He was he represented Ireland in the 1948 Olympics as a basketball player. But not only that, he went to college alongside Charles Haughey, became quite friendly with Charlie Haughey, and it was Harry along with George Colley who invited Charles Haughey to join Fianna Fáil in 1948. Now, well, that's interesting because Haughey came from a Fine Gael background, if you like. So it was the Colleys and the Bolands who brought Haughey into Fianna Fáil. But also, after the end of the war and into the early 50s, Harry Boland founded an accountancy firm with Charlie Haughey. So that relationship then was really built around a professional relationship, but also a personal relationship. So why did I go to interview Harry Boland? Because I wanted to find out about how Fianna Fáil operated at a local level, at a branch level, in terms of determining policy. And my interest is around Northern Ireland policy. So during the conversation, which Harry, you know, told me quite a lot of information about that particular era of history, he then revealed to me that upstairs in his attic, he had a copy of his father's unpublished memoir and associated papers. Now, as a young historian, when I heard this, I nearly fell off my seat, because this is something that doesn't happen all the time. Photocopies, which were written on Shannon-headed paper, handwritten memoir extracts that his father had produced in the early to mid-1960s. So I went away after that conversation, and Harry rang me later on and said, "Stephen, I've thought about this," and I said, "I'd like to give you a copy of the memoir." And again, I was taken aback, and I was very grateful. And Harry subsequently posted a copy of the memoir to me. I used some of the material from my publication, which was as a result of my PhD, which looked at Fianna Fáil in Northern Ireland. I turned to the memoir again and I said, you know what? There's a book in this. The more I read about it, because in the memoir, Boland is brutally honest. He's particularly honest around his feelings towards his contemporaries within Fianna Fáil. But not only that, his background, where he grew up in Manchester, how he became a prominent figure within the Republican movement as a member of the Irish Volunteers and subsequently within the IRA, his time in prison during the War of Independence and subsequently in prison during the Civil War when he went on hunger strike. So the information just, you know, leaped off the pages, and I decided then to produce the memoir. And what I made sure to do is that I worked closely with the Boland family throughout this project. So not only have they kindly supplied me with some beautiful photographs of the book, but they also gave me some of their own personal recollections of their grandfather. And one that sticks out is when Gerald sadly passed away, Eamon de Valera, who was then the president of Ireland, came to the family home to pay his respects. And family members vividly recall de Valera crying over Gerald's coffin, saying, "We've lost another good one, we've lost another good one." So it's those kind of snippets of history, but the oral history, which you would never really, you know, you're very fortunate to come across such examples. So yeah, being able to get access to the memoir is a new layer, if you like, of our understanding of the revolutionary period and modern Ireland. And it's not just about a biography of somebody, because Boland encapsulates that almost century of independent Ireland from the foundation of the state all the way into the 60s and indeed the early 70s and the crises around the arms crisis itself.
And I think that is what's so extraordinary about his life, the fact that you have someone who's in the biscuit factory with Thomas McDonagh in 1916, who's involved in the War of Independence and the Civil War, but then who goes on to have this huge political career afterwards and is the longest serving Minister for Justice in Irish history. So his career, his life spans so many crucial periods and crucial decades of Irish history.
Yeah, and this is the first time that I took on the task of writing a biography. Now, for those who are familiar with writing history and those who aren't, it's a very different skill set to write a biography of an individual rather than a narrative or a grand analysis of a particular event. So I found by placing Boland at the centre of these events, although he wasn't always at the centre of them, you could stitch together a fabric of the events of modern Ireland through his own experiences. You touched upon the fact he was the longest serving Minister for Justice. Extraordinary. He was Minister for Justice from 1939 to 1948, so throughout the war, and again in 1951 to 54 when Fianna Fáil came back into power. And of course, what's interesting about that period is because with the threat of foreign invasion during the height of the Second World War, and also there was collaboration between the IRA and the Nazis, Boland was at the heart of trying to protect Irish sovereignty, not only with external threats, but internal threats. And I've used the phrase poacher turned gamekeeper, because in his capacity as Minister for Justice, he was responsible for essentially signing the death warrants of a number of IRA men who were executed during the course of the war, and also refusing to allow men to come off hunger strike, and people then lost their lives in hunger strike. Now, why that's so fascinating to me is because as a revolutionary himself, as a young man in his late teens, early 20s, Boland was incarcerated during the Irish Civil War, and he went on hunger strike for approximately 40 days. So he'd experienced the very same conditions and the horrors of that period And also, you know, he was a Republican, but he always used the term new IRA when he spoke about the IRA of the 1940s. So it must have been, well, it was traumatic. I know it was from his memoir, because he speaks about receiving phone calls on a daily basis, people pleading for clemency, for not to, you know, to endorse the executions of these IRA volunteers. But Boland said he felt he had to do it. It was an obligation. He had to protect the state. But it was something, it was probably, for him, it was the most difficult period of his political career, but also his most successful period in his political career. Because by all accounts, he was a brilliant Minister for Justice. Apart from what he did during the war, he was also seen as a liberal in some ways as well.
Tell me about his relationship with Michael Collins, because he seems to have disliked him from the very beginning, and it seems to have predated what happened to his brother Harry Boland. And we have descriptions where he's calling Collins a bully, the master of the big lie, a rascal, a braggart, a propagandist. He really seems to have clashed with Collins from an early stage.
He does, and I suppose there is a caveat here. A lot of these recollections are from his memoirs and from other contemporary documents from the 60s. So they're shaped by his experiences of the Civil War, of course, and the fallout there. But before the Civil War had started, he had warned his brother Harry, do not get close to this man. He can't be trusted. And of course, Harry Boland and Collins were very close. They were best friends. That was one of the great personal tragedies of the Civil War, that they took different sides. The main area where Collins fell out with Harry was when Harry was incarcerated during the War of Independence in Frognock. And there was a propaganda campaign at the time mounted by Michael Collins, who was the best propagandist of his generation for the Republican movement. And it was about conditions in the prisons. And Collins, with the help of those who were in prison, compiled basically a memoranda which outlined the terrible treatment of Irish prisoners. And the prisons themselves signed this document. Gerald refused to sign the document, and this absolutely infuriated Collins, and he sent one of his men into the prison to again persuade Gerald to change his mind, and Gerald wouldn't. And that was really the beginnings of kind of difficult relationships between them, and then obviously that manifested itself into the Civil War and the death of his brother, and of course Collins himself dies at this period in time as well. But he always associated Collins not just as a propagandist, but he thought he was a careerist. That's the phrase he uses. That he was self-interested, promoting his own image. Again, a lot of this was unfair, but Collins' relationship with Gerald in many ways encapsulates those divisions between the pro and anti-treaty force of that generation.
There's so much in the life and career we could spend the entire show discussing him, but I want to jump ahead to when he was Minister for Justice. And apart from a three-year break in between, he was Minister for Justice between 1939 and 1954. And he had huge challenges there. And he was forced to, or he ended up using the death penalty against IRA members. So he had turned full circle from where he had been during the Civil War.
Yeah, so in the book I use the phrase poacher turned gamekeeper. So during the war, as Minister for Justice, he was essentially responsible for signing the debt warrants of three IRA prisoners during that period, and a number of other IRA men who went on hunger strike. Now, why that's important is because during the War of Independence and subsequently Civil War, Gerald Boland had himself been incarcerated. During the Civil War, he spent approximately 40 days on hunger strike and eventually came off the hunger strike. So the idea that he himself as a Republican, as a hunger striker who had spent a long period in time in prison, he spent the longest of all anti-Republican prisoners in incarceration during the Civil War, almost a year. So for him then to experience or have to essentially decide on the fate of Republican IRA internees during the war, including, you know, if they would live or die, had a profound impact on Boland personally and politically. But it also really solidified the idea that he was a principled man. And even if you spoke to opponents of Boland and critics of Boland at this time, and if you read press coverage in the media, for example, there is this acknowledgement that Boland was a man of conviction and a man of principles, which, you know, in many ways that fed into his absolute disdain for the next generation of Fianna Fáilers that came on the scene in the 1950s. And I'm talking here about Charles Haughey, for example. He saw these men as kind of ruthless, ambitious, and didn't have a sense of patriotism that the generation before, of course, had.
Why did Lamasse want him out? Was there a sense that that Lamasse needed fresh blood in the cabinet, or was there something else at play there?
Yeah, probably all of those things combined together. So in 1954, following Fianna Fáil's election defeat, Lamasse essentially was charged by De Valera to kind of revamp the organisation. So this is 54 now. So Lamasse set up numerous committees under the umbrella of the Fianna Fáil National Executive. And it was about regenerating, bringing in new blood. And that was fine. This included, let's not forget, Kevin Boland as well. So, you know, Gerald's son was part of this regeneration. Unfortunately, Gerald believed or felt that younger men like Charles Haughey and Brian Lenehan and others, they didn't really have the moral fabric that really should be part of the Fianna Fáil, you know, lineage. So he felt that this was really the beginning of the end of Fianna Fáil. Now, why Lamasse gets involved? Because Lamasse is trying to encourage this new generation to kind of take over the running of Fianna Fáil. And he's Lamasse himself, who was a pragmatist, you know, he's an economic liberal. He wanted to see Ireland prosper. So he in some ways, he had a different view of the world than Gerald Boland did. But the real bone of the contention was that in 1957, for the general election, Brian Lenehan, according to Gerald Boland, was shoehorned into the Roscommon constituency. And rather than just three Fianna Fáil candidates being put up for election, four candidates were put up, which included Brian Lenehan. Now, Brian Lenehan lost that election. He came last. But in the subsequent election of 61, with Lamasse's support, Gerald Boland did lose his seat. And it was Brian Lenehan who was the successor in Roscommon. And Gerald Boland had always felt, and I think this is fair enough, that it was Lamasse who was really masterminding this campaign behind his back. And that goes back to the point I made in 1957 when the cabinet is to be established under De Valera's chairmanship. Lamasse goes to De Valera and says, you cannot appoint Boland to cabinet because if you do, I'll resign. And that's testimonies that I've read from Charles Haughey and Patrick Hillary, of course, was a prominent minister at the time. So there was personal animosity and the political maybe manoeuvring, because that's not the guy. Not to say that Gerald Boland had really any chance of ever succeeding De Valera as president of Fianna Fáil and Taoiseach, but Lamasse was ruthless in his ambitions and maybe saw Gerald as a threat to him becoming the next leader of Fianna Fáil, which of course he does become Fianna Fáil leader in 1959. What's really interesting is, having looked at the Fianna Fáil Parliamentary Party minutes and the National Executive minutes, Lamasse does not attend the election of Sean Lamasse as president, which is extraordinary because it was such an important event. So I don't know why he didn't attend, but I imagine he didn't want to place his vote on record at the time. But when Lamasse was elected in the Dáil, Gerald Boland did attend and showed up on the day. But it just shows the animosity that it must have existed internally within Fianna Fáil, although Fianna Fáil would have never made those views known publicly, if you like.
His relationship with Fianna Fáil all goes horribly wrong at the end, and he ends up resigning from the party that he helped to found, and that's all connected with the arms crisis and what happens there. So what was the breaking point for him?
Yeah, this is one of the great tragedies of Gerald Boland's life, because in the context of the arms crisis, just for your listeners, essentially what happened was Fianna Fáil was divided down the middle between what you might refer to as constitutional Republicans and those who are more sympathetic to physical force nationalism. And that happened at cabinet level as well. So when the Battle of the Bogside broke out in August of 1969, there was discussions at a cabinet level, which Jack Lynch was the Taoiseach of the day and Charles Haughey was Minister for Finance. Gerard Boland was also Minister for Local Government. There was genuinely a conversation around, should we use the Irish Army in terms of potentially invading Northern Ireland to start border incidents, which might compel the UN to get involved. Now, in that context, there was, as Kevin Boland would have said at the time, a cover-up that the Irish government, according to the official records, and this is Jack Lynch's statement, never considered any such manoeuvring, never considered supplying Northern Republicans with weapons. But Kevin Boland was always adamant that had been discussed and that was a potential pathway forward in the pursuit of the defence of Northern Catholics. So Gerald Boland, out of a sense of obligation for his respect for his son, resigned as a Fianna Fáil trustee in 1971. So Gerald Boland, who was a co-founder of that party in 1926, left Fianna Fáil, as did Kevin. Kevin was essentially forced out because he felt that Fianna Fáil had sold out on the Republican pedigree. They'd sold out as the party of the 32 counties. And what's also fascinating about Boland, which is very unusual to many of his contemporaries, except those maybe who are from the north of Ireland, like Sean McAtee, throughout his life, he was a vocal critic of the partition of Ireland. From the moment there was an act of the Government of Ireland Act of 1920 to the Boundary Commission of 25, all the way up until the outbreak of the Troubles in 1969, 1970, Boland repeatedly spoke out against what had happened. And extraordinarily, in his last interview, which he gave to the Irish press in 1971, I believe, he said at that very time, he believed in the right circumstances, it was right to use military intervention to stop the chaos or the trauma, the conflict itself breaking out. So he held those views throughout his life. And that's interesting, given the fact during the war, of course, he was opposed to any use of force in the context of preserving Irish neutrality. But at the same time, he was willing to endorse it later on when it came to Northern Ireland. So yeah, in 1971, he left Fianna Fáil, and that was the end. He never attended another Fianna Fáil Ard Fhéin or another event. And that really manifests itself, that division, at his funeral in 1973, because Jack Lynch wasn't invited to the funeral, didn't turn up. But Erskine Childers, who was then the Taoiseach, did turn up. And he was essentially told to leave the funeral mass. He didn't leave, but other Fianna Fáil prominent ministers were forced out. Some were chased to their cars, and their ministerial cars, and they drove away. But even at the funeral, those divisions were still raw within the party. And they remain to this day. When I speak to the Boland family, they feel that their father and Kevin were done a great disservice by that organisation.
So, Stephen, it is a remarkable story and a remarkable career that covers, you know, six decades of Irish history and Irish politics. How do you think he should be remembered?
I suppose, as a biographer, I could fall into the trap of hyperbole and giving Gerald, you know, greater prominence than maybe he deserves. But what I would say is, apart from the big men of Irish history from that generation, like Michael Collins and Eamon de Valera and others, Gerald Boland does genuinely deserve a recognition for his role in helping, particularly during the Second World War, to preserve Irish neutrality and to fight against the forces, both internally and externally, which threatened the very fabric of Irish society. So for no other reason but his role as Minister for Justice during the Second World War, I believe that his reputation must be promoted, and we should never forget the contribution that he and many of his generation made to Irish society.
Well, my thanks to Stephen Kelly for joining me tonight to talk about the life and legacy of Gerald Boland. The book is called Gerald Boland's A Life. It's published in paperback by Wordwell. And Stephen, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks again. Enjoyed that.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this. Welcome back. We're Talking History. What was achieved by the Irish Free State during the Civil War was remarkable. Within a period of less than a year, they raised and equipped a standing national army of nearly 60,000 soldiers, defeating an insurgency by the anti-treaty elements of the IRA. And a new book explains how they managed to attain this remarkable achievement. The book is called Clear, Hold, Build: How the Free State Won the Irish Civil War. It's published in paperback by Eastwood Books. The author is Gareth Prendergast. And Gareth, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thank you very much, Patrick.
Can I begin with an incredible quote praising the book by General David Petraeus, the former commander of the surge in Iraq?
Yeah, I was very happy for General Petraeus to do that. He came over to Ireland around 10, 15 years ago when I was working in military college. So we've kept in contact, and he's been very supportive. And it was he and his coinistas coined the phrase clear, hold, build after what was happening in Iraq and Afghanistan. So I also did a course in America for a year. I did a command and general staff course in America, and that's how I got contact with him. So I was very keen on using that title so as to explain the counterinsurgency actions of the National Army during the Irish Civil War.
Yeah, he called it a brilliant, gripping examination of the counterinsurgency campaign waged by the Irish forces that prevailed in the Civil War, one that only an Irish writer could bring to life so vividly. Well, talk to me about Clear, Hold, Build then. What exactly does it mean, and how does this counterinsurgency framework help us to better understand the Civil War?
Quite simply, Clear, Hold, Build was a strategy or a tactic developed by the US forces during the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And initially, they went in with just a clear and a little bit of a hold, and they didn't realise how important the build was. So to explain it in layman's terms, clear is when you move into a terrain and you clear all the enemy forces out of that terrain, or the insurgents out of that terrain. And then what's most important is the actual hold. So if you take Iraq in 2003, the US Army cleared all the way to Baghdad, but they didn't have enough forces to hold the terrain as they moved north. So the insurgents came in behind them. And that's one of the key elements, that you have to hold the terrain. So hence you need a lot of forces to do that. And then finally, what turns those tactical victories or successes into overall strategic success is the build, where you have to win over the population. This is what in Vietnam they call the hearts and mind strategy. But now they're saying that you have to combine compelling kinetic with the hearts and mind strategy. And that's the build, where you rebuild the infrastructure, rebuild the governance, and rebuild the economy. And I believe that from my research and after doing the course in the US, having then read about the Irish Civil War, I thought that this was a perfect case study as to explain that strategy.
And what's interesting is you explore the challenges of building that national army. And it had incredible challenges to professionalise the group, to instill discipline, to establish legitimacy. They were recruiting from disparate forces, including ex-British soldiers and former pro-treaty IRA fighters. So that it really was a huge undertaking, moulding that group.
Absolutely massive. If you think about it, 75% of the IRA went anti-treaty because a lot of them followed their commanders, and especially in the south. The 1st Southern Division and the 2nd Southern Division nearly went completely anti-treaty following Liam Lynch and Ernie O'Malley. So Michael Collins, Richard Mulcahy had a bit of a conundrum in that they had a very small force which to build from a national army, because Article 8 of the treaty with the British said that Ireland was allowed now establish a national army or defence forces. So they had to set about doing that very quickly, and in the spate now of they didn't have the luxury of time because a civil war was starting to rage around them. So initially they had maybe a couple of thousand soldiers, and they built that on what was called the Dublin Guards, or the basically Michael Collins' squad from the Dublin area. And then the British started giving them the equipment, and that was the key to my book, was the fact that I believe that the British, when they pulled out, you don't want to leave a vacuum there. So they then decided that they would support the National Army with equipment, but they wanted to make sure that the Irish could use that equipment. And hence, you've got a ready-made workforce of professionally trained soldiers, all Irish men or women that had served in World War One. So you see Michael Collins writing to the British Legion, Mr. Walker and the Legion, looking for machine gunners, artillery men, drivers, signalers, etc. Because if you're going to get these capabilities of artillery, aircraft, etc., you need trained people and technicians to maintain them and how to fire them properly. So thus they pooled, they dipped into the pool of the amount of veterans. And at that time, there was over 150,000 veterans of World War I living in the Free State at the time. Like, there was over 100,000 in the north of the country, but in the Free State itself, there was 150,000 veterans. So as they moved from Dublin outwards, they were recruiting British Army veterans along the way. And that certainly helped turn the time and bring an element of professionalism, junior leadership and technical ability into the National Army compared to the IRA, who were basically an insurgent force. And we could see that in the Battle of Kilmallock, where disciplined soldiers fought against an insurgent force in a conventional battle.
And how effective was the National Army when it came to conventional warfare? Because as soon as it came up against guerrilla tactics, it really had to readjust its strategy.
Exactly. The first couple of months of the Civil War was conventional. And this is the clear phase, where they cleared around the Limerick area, they cleared the Waterford area, they cleared down and through the Munster Republic, because the Munster Republic had been set up for around 6 months prior to that. So they decided that the Munster Republic, and you can see Mulcahy's writing saying that once Dublin fell, there was elements up in Sligo, Mayo, etc. But the main area of resistance to the Free State was down in the Munster region, Cork, Waterford, Kerry, Limerick, Clare region. So that's where the decisive operations. So the clearance operations took place in July, August, September. And you could see the professionally trained Free State with their equipment, and especially with the artillery pieces. They got 9 18-pounder guns and thousands of rounds of ammunition. That turned the tide from, plus they had a number of armoured cars, plus they had the junior leadership from that had served in World War One. So thus, as you said, the conventional phase, they cleared all that area. It was the hold afterwards that the IRA once they lost Cork City, they moved into the mountains of North Cork and West Cork and into the Kerry area, and they regrouped and went back. Let's just say they made a mistake at the start of the war to try and fight it conventionally, but then they returned to what they knew best, and that was unconventional insurgency tactics. So thus in September, October, the tide of the war changed and the IRA brought the fight back to the National Army. And that's where in one of my chapters in my book talk about a modern army having to be a learning organisation, and the Free State developed new tactics. And you can see that November, December, and then the war again in 1923, they got the momentum again back on the Free State side.
And in terms of establishing civil security, how successful was the National Army? Because they seem to have been successful in embedding in local communities, and that helped in terms of intelligence and control and eroding IRA support. And it seems they were better at holding territory.
They were. As they started going down and recruiting into the areas, especially around the Cork area and the Munster area, because at the time Cork was a 50-50 county, and that it was split evenly between anti and pro-treaty forces. Plus there was a huge proportion of ex-British Army veterans in Cork. Like Cork City itself had a population of 76,000. 16,000 of them were veterans of World War One, whether in the Navy or the Army. And they filtered out to a strength, overall strength by the end of the Civil War, that was 5,500 soldiers recruited into Cork, and they were split around 68 posts. And it's called the ink spot theory, where you basically, you don't commute to work in an insurgency. You have to live in the villages, you have to live amongst the population, and you have to provide that security, as you said, the civil security and the civil control. You have to reassure the population that you're not just going to stay there for 12 hours and then return back to your big base. You have to live with the population, and that's what they did. They situated all the Free State around the Cork area, and they were Cork soldiers, born and bred, so they knew the local intelligence, they knew the local population, compared to Kerry, where they couldn't recruit locally. Only 25% of the force in Kerry was locally recruited, and that's why we see a lot more atrocities in Kerry compared to Cork. Plus, they had a lot of more freedom of movement in Cork. They had a lot of vehicles that the British had given them, and by the end of the Civil War, most of the posts in Cork had an armoured vehicle, which allowed them the freedom of movement to move between the posts and to extend the build. And then the build kicked in, where they started, you can read the reports, the after action reports, they're in the National Archives there, how young officers are going into the towns and villages of Cork and Kerry and Clare, and getting people to rebuild the infrastructure that's broken, putting security in for fairs. The Americans thought they invented that in Afghanistan and Iraq, but 100 years prior to that, the National Army were doing it, and that was reassuring the population. Population mightn't have supported them, but the population tolerated them and preferred the peace that they were giving, rather than the anarchy, say, that the anti-treaty IRA were trying to do in the area, especially with their destruction of the infrastructure. So they mightn't have supported the National Army, but the key to an insurgency is to get them to tolerate you and to show that you're probably the best option available to them.
And that goes back to what you were saying about winning hearts and minds. By rebuilding the infrastructure, they were also building the state's legitimacy.
100%. Now, I'm not, and I don't skirt around the issue, there was a lot of atrocities committed by both sides in the war. I gave a talk down in Kerry there last year. My father, who was very nervous about me going down there, just said there was a lot of bad things done by both sides. And after the talk, Gerry Collins, the former Minister for Justice, was at it. And he said to me, Sean Lamass actually said that quote. And I thought that was quite significant, considering what happened to his brother in the Civil War, or after the Civil War. So, yes, there was a lot of bad things done by both sides. I don't in no way excuse the actions of both sides in my book. I just try to look at it at an unbiased way and try to explain the strategy that was developed. And as you rightly said, it was the build. It was rebuilding the infrastructure, rebuilding the economy, alienating the IRA from the local population, forcing them to commandeer trucks and cattle and etc. And also bringing governance into the area. And people just want a safe and secure environment that they can carry on with their daily life and get back into commerce and make a bit of money to support their families. And that's what they tried to do.
Being adaptive seems to have been hugely important, and the Irish National Army and the administration seem to have been able to learn from early mistakes and become more coordinated and flexible, and adaptation seems to have been crucial to its success.
100%. Yeah, you have to be an adaptive. If you keep doing the same thing over again and expecting different results, it's not going to work. You have to adapt. And this is, in most military academies throughout the world, one of the key elements that they teach you is to be an adaptive learner, how to be flexible, and how to discover that if it isn't working, how do we do it another way to make sure it works? And you can see the National Army, and you can see Mulcahy writing to the other generals and saying, let's ask the British Army veterans how they can help us change the army that we have now so as to be adaptive. He said it begrudgingly, but he realised he had to use their knowledge and their know-how that they had gained from fighting in World War One. So they brought in some of the key factors like counter-columns. I go into that. That's probably a precursor to special forces, that they would use the less trained soldiers to put a cordon in, and then the better trained soldiers would go in to the areas after a sweep had been done to try and sweep out the flying columns. These were similar type soldiers to a flying columns. They also reorganized the whole of the National Army into battle groups. And these are self-sufficient fighting units with their own medical signals, artillery, backup to them. And then they also got the freedom of movement. They made sure they had armoured vehicles and vehicles to every post, so to give that mobility so they could spread around and give better security. And they also did an emphasis on employment and getting the population working and winning over the hearts and minds, and basically alienating and discrediting the IRA in the area. And they had great help from the Catholic Church and the press as well, because the Catholic Church basically as a whole came out in force against the... Now, there was elements, obviously, that supported the IRA, but the majority of priests would preach at their pulpits, and there was a couple of examples where IRA members and their families were excommunicated. And this is serious, significant incidences in 1920s Ireland. To be excommunicated or even to be refused a Eucharist at Mass is quite significant, and this was going on at the time.
How did the National Army learn so quickly all these different techniques and approaches, given that this is quite sophisticated military strategic thinking? It's something that was used in, you know, the 21st century by the United States Army. How were they able to learn all these things in terms of how to counteract what the IRA was doing, how to adapt so quickly? They had experience of the War of Independence, but they didn't have the high level experience that you think was probably necessary.
This was the key to my learnings, and I did my doctoral thesis on this, in that I had come home from America and I'd learned all this civil control, civil security, host nation support, reconstruction, restoration of infrastructure, all these key counterinsurgency terms. And then I read Sean Boyne's excellent book on Emmett Dalton. And as I was reading his book, all this started just jumping out from the page for me. And I just was wondering, how did they know how to do that? How did a 24-year-old major general in the National Army know how to do it? Yes, he had served in the British Army, but what theorists had he written or read, I should say? Like, Caldwell was one of the few theorists out at the time, and he talked about small wars, he talked about disinformation, he talked about irregular warfare, etc. But at that time, there wasn't many people writing about counterinsurgency. But I read through all the Ontogluk magazines, and that's what the Free State National Army had, was their magazine that they had to pass information out. And they were key on talking about how to do ambushes, how to be embedded with the population, how to defend local villages. So it was from their learnings, maybe, that British Army veterans are from, as you said, in the War of Independence, they realised the mistakes that the British had made and how they would try and counter that and do it better. So it still is a mystery how the majority of them were in their 20s and 30s and how they knew how to do it. And this is the whole idea of my book, that I want to show that a lot of people would talk about the Free State Army, and of course they were going to win because they had more soldiers and more equipment. But you can easily turn tactical victories into strategic failures and become an occupation force. Now, they did in certain areas, and especially in Kerry, but as a whole, they practiced what was, as you said rightly, what is now being taught in military academies throughout the world in the 21st century. So I'm hoping that my book becomes a case study on how you can do it somewhat correctly and we can learn from it.
So why do you think the Irish Free State won the Civil War? Was it, you know, I suppose a combination of reasons, but was part of it because they were able to offer this more attractive alternative to the anti-treatyites, and part of that was the work that the army was doing?
Yes, the army was an instrument of the state, and it allowed the state provide security to the population. And I have to also say that the state then provided the Garda Síochán, or the civic guard, who came in behind that. And you can see Mulcahy writing that in areas where it's pretty safe, we can now move out and let the civic guard take over so as to normalise the situation. They provided an alternative. They provided a safe and secure environment. Because if you think about it, Ireland had been sort of a decade since 1913 to now 1923. The population was tired. The population had gone through World War One, the War of Independence, 1916, and now we had a vicious civil war. So the population were tired. They mightn't have supported the treaty. They mightn't have been very happy that we didn't get the full republic. But I think the population were war weary. The Free State proved that they weren't as bad as they had made out to be. There was a lot of propaganda on both sides. And when they started, it was the bills that turned the tactical victories into the strategic success.
Well, it's a brilliant new book. It's called Clear, Hold, Build, How the Free State Won the Irish Civil War. It's published in paperback by Eastwood Books. The author is Gareth Prendergast. And Gareth, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much, Patrick. Pleasure.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this. Welcome back. We're Talking History. History shifts languages, languages shape history, a deep-rooted dynamic process manifest in Victorian Ireland. And it's in this period that we see develop an adaptive, fast-changing academic landscape, which laid the groundwork for today's Ireland, culturally confident, open to Europe and the world. And a new book draws on multiple sources to cast a fresh light on aspects of Irish history viewed through the complex lens of language education. The book is called Foreign Tongues, Victorian Language Learning and Modern Ireland. It's published in paperback by UCD Academic Press. The author is Phyllis Gaffney. And Phyllis, you're very welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Patrick.
Can I begin with how you got into writing this book?
An email landed in my mailbox from a colleague. She wanted to know, had I any idea when French and other modern languages were begun to be taught at UCD, or UCD's ancestor, well, UCD. So I said, well, it's pretty well from the beginning. It's obvious, you know, it must have been from when Newman opened the doors. The Catholic University of Ireland had French and indeed Italian and Spanish and German on offer. But when I went online just to check a few facts, I found that the story was much more complex than that, because Ireland was a bit of an outlier in this vis-a-vis England and Scotland's universities, where modern languages were not. So I got fascinated by the story, and I saw immediately what I had to say. I saw the narrative very clearly. You know, read material that I discovered, very good historical material that had been published since I did my degree in the last century in history and French. And I really enjoyed it, and I wrote it very fast because I was compelled to write it. I had to tell this story because I saw so many interesting things.
It's really fascinating. Viewing Irish educational history through this language glass offers a new way of understanding class, gender, empire, and indeed how modern Ireland developed.
Yeah, that's what I came to conclude quite early on. And when you think about language learning and language education in the 20th century and post-independence Ireland, the Irish language looms large. But one of the first discoveries I made when I started getting into the project, the research project in earnest, was the complete neglect of Irish language, except Old Irish. Celtic philology was very, very respectable, but nobody thought of teaching Cainte na Nina until the champions came along on their white horses at the end of the Victorian period, the Gaelic League. And in a way, that does really shape what happens. It shapes the agenda for language teaching in the 20th century. All of the resources, all of the policies and so on were poured into keeping Irish going, whereas modern languages, the first government policy was 2017 in the south of Ireland. But it did shape because of the very language-heavy curriculum that the NUI laid down. University policies were extremely important. So those late Victorian and Edwardian decades were, I genuinely believe, crucial for the way education was carried on in post-independent Ireland, the sense that, you know, really university policies on different disciplines shape the secondary school curriculum, and that does shape the culture, whether we like it or not.
Institutional policies were exactly. hugely important. But as you show, individual professors were also very important as well. They were shaping the curriculum, they were setting the exams, indeed. And they were often driving or resisting change.
Indeed, some of them were very set in their ways. They didn't want to include any contemporary texts in their the prescribed texts that they set. They thought that really, you know, French literature stopped at the 18th century, possibly the 19th. And it was only the odd one who dared to put a contemporary text or a more, you know, a text closer to the time. But and they were also, I mean, the other interesting point about post-independence Ireland is the neglect of the oral. I mean, the oral was neglected in the 19th century. The 19th century was all about the written language. It was about the history of the language, history of the literature, its canonical writers, and if some professors may have used the target language in their classes, they certainly didn't assess it the way it's assessed now. You know, the real volte-face and the real revolution in language teaching came, I think, didn't come until the 1960s. I mean, there was no oral examination in the leaving certificate until 1960. Other modern languages didn't come to the 1980s. This astounds my children, who, you know, all born in the 70s and 80s.
There also seems to have been a really interesting gender divide, where boys seem to have been pushed to study the classics and those kinds of subjects, whereas girls were encouraged to do modern languages.
Very much so. Well, that goes back to tradition and history. Girls didn't need to do classics. What would they need classics for? They couldn't become clergymen. They couldn't become administrators. They might find some very rude things in some of those classical texts and art. So when modern languages were opened up to girls, which would have been from the, say, the 1878, 1879, really, that's the crucial date. They did more modern languages. So the boys might be going to the Jesuits and doing Latin and Greek. Their sisters would be going to the Loreto or St. Louis or Ursulines and finding nuns who taught them very thoroughly. They gave them a very good grounding in French and German, and some of them did Italian as well.
And then some of those graduates ended up becoming professors themselves and going on to teach and shape the next generation.
Yes, yes. As I say in the book, the German departments in post-independent Irish universities were a matriarchy for most of the 20th century. People forget that. Yeah, that was the NUI allowing, first of all, I mean, I think to go back to the history of the education structures for a moment, it was the mid-Victorian universities, the Queen's Colleges in Belfast, Galway and Cork, that began to take modern languages seriously. By that I mean you couldn't get a degree in those colleges, and a degree in anything. It wasn't just arts, it was philosophy, engineering, law, whatever, without doing two sessions, which was roughly a semester, two semesters of French or German. For modern languages, read French and German. And 30 years later, so it's all in three decades, it's kind of the Queen's University dissolves and becomes the Royal University of Ireland. And the Royal University of Ireland, the RUI, had two very relevant policies when it came into being, where language teaching is concerned. One is they actually dropped the requirement for Latin and Greek. They said you could do one classic. This is for your matric to get into the Royal Colleges. This would be the Belfast, Cork, Galway, and what was to become UCD, the Catholic University. It was a Jesuit university then. But you had to take for your matriculation a classical language, and then in lieu of another classical language, you could take a modern language. This was extraordinary. I mean, English universities, the later red brick universities, I mean, later 19th century ones, were beginning to do the same around then, but certainly not the elite universities. I mean, Latin and Cambridge and Oxford, absolutely not. But the second policy of the RUI that is really important for language learning is that they agreed to allow girls to be awarded a degree. And when I say agreed, there had been pressure, as you know, I'm sure better than I do, the women advocates for equal treatment in where education is concerned, post-primary education is concerned. But both of those were therefore from the 1880s. From 1884, the first RUI women graduates graduate in 1884. And that's, you know, Trinity boasts of being, you know, its first women graduates, 1904. 1884 is at least a generation before then. So a lot of those female students were very well grounded at school by the nuns, mostly, not all, but a lot of them were. And when the NUI is founded in when it comes into being, 1908-09, the National University, that's the RUI, is the forerunner of the National University. Well, it's the same group of colleges, except Queen's does a Quexit. Queen's stands on its own. It becomes independent. But the others allowed women, they agreed, they said, why not? You know, women could become, get chairs. And quite a lot of them did, because they were so able. In fact, for the first chair of the first woman professor to become Professor of Modern Languages in Ireland, Mary Ryan in Cork. I seem to remember all of the candidates were female, or was it that all of the candidates for the chair were female? So gender and modern languages is quite a strand in the book, if you like.
Well, it is a fascinating study. It is called Foreign Tongues, Victorian Language Learning and Modern Ireland. It's published in paperback by UCD Academic Press. The author is Phyllis Gaffney. And Phyllis, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
You're very welcome. Thank you very much for having me.
And that brings us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Marisa O'Sullivan, and Peter Malloy on sound. We've got more debate and discussion next week, so hope you can join us then. We've been Talking History. Good night.